This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello there. It is good to have you with us on the program today. This is Joel Hilliker. I want to talk about what is happening in our public schools. What are we teaching our children? It seems like every week there are more headlines answering those questions in ways that are deeply troubling. We'll start by just looking at some recent stories, but as we go through these, I want you to ask yourself what sort of effects this will have on society and on civilization as we know it when we raise a generation to have these kinds of ideas. We'll start with an article from The New American from October 3rd. It's discussing a proposal in Washington State for a new way to teach math. It says a government school document shows that students in Seattle will learn math in a, quote, ethnic studies framework that depicts the subjects as oppressive and that the right answer to a math question might be relative to a person's ethnicity and culture. The curriculum will teach, and this is quoting directly from the school's document, the ways in which individuals and groups define mathematical knowledge so as to see, quote, Western mathematics as the only legitimate expression of mathematical identity and intelligence. This definition of legitimacy is then used to disenfranchise people and communities of color. And I'll share with you some of the learning targets from this curriculum. It says that it will identify how math has been and continues to be used to oppress and marginalize people and communities of color. Explain how math and technology and/or science are connected, and how technology and/or science have been used and continue to be used to oppress and marginalize people and communities of color. Identify the inherent inequalities of the standardized testing system used to oppress and marginalize people and communities of color. And here's from a section in the curriculum called Essential Questions. The overall question of what does it mean to do math will impart the truth that one man's right answer, quote unquote, might not be another's. It asks, how important is it to be right? What is right? Says who? Who holds power in a mathematical classroom? Who gets say if an answer is right? How is math manipulated to allow inequality and oppression to persist? So math, this is as objective as you can get in a subject, and they are transforming this into a deeply radical, racist teaching. Can you imagine a child who's working on a math problem and being instructed that if you get the answer to this math problem wrong, the reason is that you are being oppressed because of your skin color? That is absolutely amazing. And I have a hard time believing that anyone could actually think that this will help a student, that this would help a child to begin to think that way, rather than learning how to do it correctly. Getting the idea that they're being oppressed if a math problem is marked incorrect. Now, this kind of politicized curriculum is spreading in our public schools more and more. Leftist educators are using their positions to shape the views of the next generation and turn them into tomorrow's activists and radicals. Last month on Fox News, Tucker Carlson did a segment on a new curriculum that is being implemented in schools, not just in liberal states or districts, but across the country. The curriculum is called Deep Equity, and it's produced by a California-based for-profit education company called Corwin. This program is meant to neutralize various oppressions that are supposedly inherent within American society. And I'll just play a little bit of his report. He's making his way through this deep equity curriculum materials. This is what he says about it.
According to Corwin, differences in academic performance have nothing to do with culture or effort. They are purely the product of racism. In order to fight that racism, teachers are instructed on different types of, quote, white identity orientations. This is all pseudoscience, you may notice. Many white people, teachers are told by Deep Equity, are defined by their, quote, ignorance and supremacy. Other whites, meanwhile, quote, question the systemic issues that have caused whites to be so much in a superior position. The curriculum offers what it calls a, quote, white allies action agenda. Among the items on that list, quote, acknowledge the reality of white racial privilege, educate other white people, use your privilege to work for racial and social justice. Feel sick yet? According to one teacher we spoke to who has used this curriculum, the Deep Equity curriculum forces teachers to become racial activists. Not that you need to interview anyone to find that out. It's obvious. They're not teaching anything having to do with math or science or English or language. They're teaching racial activism, certain to confuse and wound and divide our kids of all colors.
Last Friday on the Week in Review program, we talked about Portland Public Schools, the largest school district in Oregon, and what they're teaching about Thanksgiving and American history. I want to give a little more detail about this story. Portland Public Schools made the month of November Native American Heritage Month. The National Congress of American Indians said that it's intended to, quote, celebrate rich and diverse cultures, traditions, and histories, and to acknowledge the important contributions of Native people. But this is not just a positive curriculum intended to teach people about these various Native American tribes. They use as a text Howard Zinn's book, A Young People's History of the United States. Andrew Miller talked about this last week, but this book treats all these tribes, the way that it speaks about them, they're all generous, they're all saintly, and it demonizes all the European settlers as being greedy and violent. This is how the Federalist reported on this last week. The text describes the Arawaks as being, quote, like the Indians on the American mainland and all, quote, believed in hospitality and sharing. But Columbus was hungry for money. So as soon as he arrived in the islands, he seized some Arawaks by force so that he could get information from them, namely the answer to where is the gold? As a result, the Europeans enslaved, tortured, and executed the Arawaks to extinction. Columbus's landing was, quote, the start of the history of the Europeans in the Americas. It was a history of conquest, slavery, and death. So this book, which they're giving to eighth graders, it aims to tell, quote, the story of the discovery of America from the point of view of the Arawaks and of the Constitution from the point of view of the slaves, and so on and so forth. You get the idea. The eighth graders reading this, they read that the tragedy of Columbus and the Arawaks happened over and over again. Spanish conquerors Hernan Cortes and Francisco Pizarro destroyed the Aztecs of Mexico and the Incas of South America. When English settlers reached Virginia and Massachusetts, they did the same things to the Indians they met. Now, this school district recommends all kinds of extra resources for celebrating the Native American Heritage Month. And one of these is a video that was produced by Teen Vogue. And it depicts six teenage girls. They look like Native American teenagers. And they're sitting behind a table that is covered with a traditional Thanksgiving meal spread. They've got the turkey and all of the trimmings on the table. I'll just play this clip for you.
Happy Thanksgiving, America. I'm Donna, and I'm here with my friends to tell you the real history behind this holiday. Growing up, I knew that what they told you in school about Thanksgiving wasn't true. That's not the true story. The true story behind Thanksgiving was, after every killing of a whole village, these European settlers celebrated it, and they called it Thanksgiving. But it wasn't until Abraham Lincoln became president that it became an official holiday.
He ordered 38 Dakota men to be hung for war crimes
after the sacred holiday, Christmas.
We take this time to remember our elders who lost their lives due to what really happened. Usually my mom makes a Native American dish for us and we pray.
Growing up, I would be kind of annoyed that they didn't know what actually happened on Thanksgiving and that they're actually celebrating the deaths of many people and many tribes that were lost.
Whether it's to give thanks or to be with your family, you should learn how the holiday was established in the first place.
I'm thankful for being born indigenous to this continent.
I'm thankful that I still have my culture.
I'm thankful that my elders kept our culture alive all these years.
I'm thankful to be indigenous, resilient, and alive.
I'm thankful for us all to be able to stand together, stand strong, and stand as one.
Happy Thanksgiving, America.
The sound at the end of that clip was the girls all standing up and angrily flipping over the Thanksgiving table. So imagine the 13-year-olds who are indoctrinated with this teaching, going to their family's Thanksgiving dinner, and they're sitting there at the table and they're thinking that, as one of those girls said, they're actually celebrating the deaths of many people and many tribes that were lost. I'm sure that the people who put this curriculum together would be very pleased if those young teens ended up lecturing their parents about genocide and war crimes and cultural appropriation. I don't think those educators would necessarily be too disappointed if the kid flipped the table over at Thanksgiving. Just think about how pernicious this is. And in this example in particular, of all the holidays celebrated in America, this is the one that focuses on a positive virtue and an important aspect of healthy thinking, thanksgiving, being grateful for your blessings. And I think there's just no clearer picture of how toxic and destructive this leftist agenda is than to twist this day into an excuse to hate your country even more and to view your God-given blessings as evidence of racism and hatred. But that's what they're teaching children in our public schools. What else are they teaching? Back in 2016, the Portland Public Schools, the same district, passed a resolution called the Resolution to Develop an Implementation Plan for Climate Literacy. Climate literacy. And this resolution says Portland Public Schools will abandon the use of any adopted text materials that is found to express doubt about the severity of the climate crisis or its root in human activities. So here are some key goals outlined in the Portland resolution. Redefine our economies and call for an end to the fossil fuel era. Redefine our economies. They're talking about free market versus socialist economies. Develop and implement curriculum that addresses climate change and climate justice in all Portland public schools. Another key goal, all students should see themselves as activists and leaders for social justice and environmental justice. Now, what is social justice? Well, one of the leading education for sustainability groups called Facing the Future defines social justice this way. Social justice is the movement towards eliminating oppression and ultimately achieving equality in the distribution of goods and wealth among all groups in a society. So these kids are learning all about the evils of free markets. They're learning about all the lovely benefits of wealth redistribution and socialist programs. There was an article on Town Hall January 28th of earlier this year called America's Public Schools Have Become Socialist Indoctrination Factories. And it cites this national survey by the Education Week Research Center showing that in K through 12 schools, only 27% of teachers identify as Republicans. So you have 3 out of 4 educators in these schools who presumably are Democrat or libertarian or something to that effect. But it's no surprise then that socialist ideas permeate nearly every aspect of government-run schools, this article says. It talks about eliminating competition, giving trophies for participation rather than for winning something. It says in many schools, students don't earn letter grades anymore. We wouldn't want the poor performers to feel badly. Most children no longer extensively read the literary classics, and many high schoolers spend little time enrolled in civics or history courses. And then, of course, when they are taught history, it tends to be like the history that we heard about regarding Thanksgiving, revisionist history that makes the United States look like the most evil nation that ever existed. So the outgrowth of all of this really should not surprise us. A 2018 Gallup poll showed that a majority of 18 to 29-year-olds have a positive view of socialism versus capitalism, 55% compared to 45%. There was an article in the Telegraph, November 6th, that said a few years ago, Survation was commissioned by New Culture Forum to do a poll of 16 to 24-year-olds. It found that 28% had never heard of Stalin, almost half had never heard of Lenin, and an astonishing 70% had never heard of Mao Zedong, whose regime was responsible for more deaths through murder and famine than any other in the 20th century. Now, that is a tragedy. Those young people need that history, or else we are guaranteed to fall into the same traps and make the same mistakes that so many people have made throughout history. Those lessons of history were written at a very high cost. They are invaluable lessons of history, and they're being absolutely thrown away. All this political indoctrination is having a powerful effect on our young people, and it's changing the course of society. This was an article from Dayspring Christian Academy, January 2018. It's called Christian Students in Public Schools Grounded in Socialism. And it talks about a group called the Nehemiah Institute that gives an annual test of high school students to identify people's worldview in five categories: politics, economics, education, religion, and social issues. So they're basically asking, does this person's views agree with the Bible or with a secular worldview? They're looking for answers to questions like, did God create the world? What is the source of morality? What's the source of right and wrong? What's the role of government in society? And do those views match with what the Bible says, or are they secular views? So this article says student scores will place their worldview in four categories: biblical theism, moderate Christian, secular humanism, or socialism. In 2015, the test showed that 90% of the students from Christian homes attending public schools score in a range that indicates their views are firmly grounded in basic tenets of secularism. So what this is saying is that the teaching of the schools is more powerful than the teaching at home. Kids are growing up in what this poll says is a Christian home, and 90% of those kids that are going to public school end up with views that are secular rather than Bible-based. 90%. How important is the education of our children? You can see that these educators take this job very seriously. There's a proverb, Proverbs 22 verse 6, that says, "Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it." That's what God tells us as parents. We have a responsibility to train them in the way they should go while we have the opportunity, when they're young. So it'll set them for success throughout their lives. These educators are applying the very same principle for perverse ends. They know that if they can implant these concepts into young minds, that they'll have them for life. This is a powerful, potent way that they can reshape society. I want to talk about more of what the Bible says about our parental responsibility as educators. Obviously, if we're going to train our children in the way they should go, we have to know what that way is. So many parents today don't know the way that their kids should go. So they're just allowing these educators to move in and fill their minds with all kinds of error. If you know the right way, God says you are duty-bound to teach that way. A crucial means of preserving knowledge, preserving the law of God, preserving right morality, guarding history, guarding our spiritual heritage, a crucial means is to teach our children. It's a critical responsibility that God gives us as parents and as grandparents. And what happens if we fail? Well, then that way will be forgotten. That knowledge dies. In fact, it will die out in a single generation if it's not passed on. It dies in a generation. You look in the Old Testament, and Moses had a lot to say about this. This is the man who led Israel out of Egypt. He led them for 40 years in the wilderness. And as that first faithless generation died out in the wilderness, they made their way to the promised land. When they were finally ready to go in, everyone who was 60 years old and up had died out, except for Moses, Joshua, and Caleb. And Moses delivered three messages to the nation to prepare them to receive this awesome inheritance. He prepared them to thrive in the promised land. And these messages that he gave, they're recorded in the book of Deuteronomy. And this book is full of wonderful practical instruction from this aged patriarch, Moses. This is his final instruction to God's people just before he died and they inherited the promised land. And he repeatedly emphasized parents' duty to pass their spiritual wisdom down to their children and their grandchildren. This is what it says in Deuteronomy 4, verses 5 through 10. Behold, I have taught you statutes and judgments, even as the Eternal my God commanded me, that you should do so in the land where you go to possess it. Only take heed to yourself and keep your soul diligently, lest you forget the things which your eyes have seen, and lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life. But teach them your sons and your sons' sons, especially the day that you stood before the Eternal your God in Horeb, when the Eternal said unto me, gather the people together, I'll make them to hear my words, that they may learn to fear me all the days that they shall live upon the earth, and that they may teach their children. It's very clear what he's saying. If you don't teach this, then it's going to die with you. And he even implies there, or says outright, that if you don't teach it, then you're going to forget it. Teaching it is part of your responsibility, and this is the way that you remember it and that the nation remembers it. This is how we ensure that this truth doesn't die. He repeated this basically in Deuteronomy 6. It says, now these are the commandments, the statutes, and the judgments which the Eternal your God commanded to teach you, that you might do them in the land where you go to possess it, that you might fear the Eternal your God, to keep all his statutes and commandments which I command you, you and your son and your son's son, all the days of your life, and that your days may be prolonged. So he says, you got to teach it to your children and your grandchildren. He's talking about multiple generations relating to one another and cherishing and holding on to this precious knowledge. This continues, verse 3, hear therefore, O Israel, and observe to do it, that it may be well with you, and that you may increase mightily, as the Eternal God of your fathers has promised you, in the land that flows with milk and honey. Hear, O Israel, the Eternal our God is one Lord, and you shall love the Lord with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your might. And these words which I command you this day shall be in your heart. And verse 7 says, and you shall teach them diligently unto your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. So God is saying, you've got to reinforce these lessons throughout the day, at home, when you're away from home. Talk about it each night before bedtime. Talk about it each morning when you get up. Parents and children should be interacting often, and the Bible should be a regular topic of discussion. And there's so much detail in this passage. He emphasizes diligence and repetition because he knows our natural tendency as parents is to neglect this. It's to let this duty slip. So this emphasizes fathers have to teach their sons so that their sons know how to be fathers so that they can teach their sons. We have a book called Child Rearing with Vision, and it's available on our literature library. If you go to thetrumpet.com, you can look it up under the literature tab. It's an excellent, excellent book on how to teach children, how to grow, how to make sure that our children grow up the right way, that we actually know how to train them in the way that they should go, and we do it the way that God intends. But there's a section in here on pages 54 through 56 called Parents Are Teachers, and I'll just read a couple of paragraphs here. A child must be taught how to live. When God created the human family, he intended that parents be the child's first teachers. Be prepared to educate your child from the moment he or she is born. Don't wait for a school teacher to educate your child. You should view all school teachers as your assistants, not as your child's primary educators. Now, that's really something to think about when you consider what is being taught in public schools. You know, are these teachers really assisting you, or are they contradicting what you're trying to teach at home? It's really important that you know. You should view all school teachers as your assistants, not your child's primary educators. How important that is. This book talks about three types of knowledge. First, knowledge for a strong relationship with God. Second, knowledge on strong relationships with others. And then third, knowledge about material things. And all three of these are really important. This book says, at every milestone of your child's growth, be ready to first teach him about God and his ways, then how to get along with others, and then how to deal with things. Now, the world really only teaches children about the third thing, and it gives them really perverse ideas about those other two if it teaches it at all. But we have a responsibility to teach them about God and about relationships with others. The book says, train a child to think and decide according to the spirit and attitude of God's law. Love toward others, consideration for the good and welfare of others, and teach him that Satan's way of selfishness and jealousy, envy, antagonism toward others is wrong. Teach a child to honor his parents. There's a lot of instruction in this book along those lines, and it is invaluable. If you have children, you need this book, Child Rearing with Vision. Just to go back to Moses' instruction in Deuteronomy chapter 11, you see the same instruction again. He emphasizes it. It says, therefore, you shall love the Eternal your God and keep his charge and his statutes and his judgments and his commandments always. And notice, it says, and know you this day. Think about what he's saying here. For I speak not with your children, which have not known and which have not seen the chastisement of the Eternal your God, his greatness, his mighty hand, and his stretched out arm, and his miracles, and his acts, which he did in the midst of Egypt unto Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, and unto all his land, and what he did to the army of Egypt, unto their horses and their chariots, how he made the water of the Red Sea to overflow them as they pursued after you, and how the Eternal has destroyed them unto this day. But your eyes have seen all the great acts of the Eternal which he did. So what he's saying, again, if you think about the generation that came out of Egypt and actually witnessed God destroy the Egyptian army, they saw it with their own eyes. Well, it would be all of those who were 20 years old and under who were still around at the time that they were ready to go in the promised land. Everyone over 20 years old died in the wilderness. So he's essentially talking to the group of people who were between age 60 and however young they would have been who would still remember that, maybe 3 or 4 or 5 years old at the youngest, those who were maybe 42, 43, 44, 45 years old. That's the group that he's talking to, and he's basically telling them, your children didn't experience this. And so if your children are going to be able to learn what God did, if they're going to recognize that history, you have to teach them. You have to share that knowledge with them, or else it's just going to die out. And then Moses continues, therefore shall you keep all the commandments which I command you this day, that you may be strong and go in to possess the land where you go to possess it, and that you may prolong your days in the land which the Eternal swear to your fathers to give to them and to their seed, a land that flows with milk and honey. You know, it's painful to read this knowing what happened to the Israelites. I mean, they inherited that land. They went in there and they had a short period where they were mighty and it was great. And then they began to fall away within a very short amount of time after Joshua, who succeeded Moses, died. And the men who are around him to help him. And you entered the period of the judges. And then you just follow this history. Hundreds of years of history through the book of Judges, through especially the book of Kings, 1 and 2 Kings, that describes so much idolatry and spiritual failure among the Israelites because the parents didn't heed Moses' command here. They didn't fulfill their responsibility as educators. He was telling them how to thrive in that land, how to prolong their days. Verses 18 through 20 of Deuteronomy 11 say, therefore shall you lay up these my words in your heart and in your soul, and bind them for a sign upon your hand, that they may be as frontlets between your eyes. And you shall teach them your children, speaking of them when you rise in your house, and when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise up. You shall write them upon the doorposts of your house and upon your gates. And what is it all for? Verse 21, that your days may be multiplied and the days of your children in the land which the Eternal swear to your fathers to give them, as the days of heaven upon the earth. Moses had witnessed so much failure among Israel's families, and you can sense his urgency as he's telling them this. This man who was 120 years old, talking to the families of Israel, commit these words to your heart and teach them diligently to your children. Discuss them every chance you get, because this is how to survive as a nation. You obey this command and it welds the individual families into a single nation under God. It ensures national stability. It guarantees Israel's future as a godly nation. If the parents in Israel had diligently followed this command to teach their children, to educate them in this way, the nation would have survived. They never would have departed from God's way. Sadly, that isn't what happened. But doesn't it make sense? Doesn't it make sense? If you think about just knowledge, history, understanding, wisdom that a generation may have, whether they were given it by God or however they came to have it, that real wisdom, if they don't teach it, it dies. This isn't even a particularly deep spiritual concept. It's really common sense. At one time, Americans seemed to understand it. One of America's founders, Benjamin Rush, he was a signer of the Declaration of Independence. He wrote a publication called A Defense of the Use of the Bible as a Schoolbook. Here's a quote from that book. Before I state my arguments in favor of teaching children to read by means of the Bible, I shall assume the following propositions. First, that Christianity is the only true and perfect religion. and that in proportion as mankind adopt its principles and obeys its principles, they will be wise and happy. Second, that a better knowledge of this religion is to be acquired by reading the Bible than in any other way. Finally, that the Bible contains more knowledge necessary to man in his present state than any other book in the world. That's what Benjamin Rush wrote, and this really was very common thinking at the time of America's founding. Here's a quote from Samuel Adams, who really is considered the father of the American Revolution. "Let divines and philosophers, statesmen and patriots unite their endeavors to renovate the age by impressing the minds of men with the importance of educating their little boys and girls, of inculcating in the minds of youth the fear and love of the deity and universal philanthropy, and in subordination to these great principles, the love of their country, of instructing them in the art of self-government, without which they can never act a wise part in the government of societies, great or small. In short, of leading them in the study and practice of the exalted virtues of the Christian system." Pretty extraordinary. I mean, that's one of America's most famous founders talking like that. That generation was grounded in biblical principles. And you know what? They expected that to be a major foundation in the education of the young people. Something has clearly changed radically since that time. The introduction of humanist thinking, secular thinking into schools, banishing the Bible from education, expelling moral instruction, evicting God altogether from schools. It's changed radically. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll talk about more of what is happening in our public schools today and about our responsibility as parents to counteract that and to be our children's educators. It is our duty for the preservation of what is right and good. Please stay with us.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Public schools in America and in other Western nations are increasingly turning into indoctrination centers for radical leftist thinking. Educators are training our children to be socialists, to be environmental activists, racial activists. They're being trained to hate white people, to hate America. And sadly, it's not just political indoctrination that educators are forcing on our children. Here's what else they're teaching. This is from an article by KXAN. This is an NBC affiliate in Austin, Texas, from October 28th. Early Tuesday morning, Austin Independent School District's board unanimously approved a controversial new sex education curriculum. The curriculum spans grades 3-8. Under the new curriculum, for the first time, the district will teach students about gender identity and sexual orientation. The lessons will also help kids identify an adult they can trust, plus talk to them about options if they get pregnant, and seventh graders would learn how to use a condom. Seventh graders, 12-year-olds. I have a son in seventh grade. He's 12 years old. He's attending school at Imperial Academy. This is the K-12 school that's here on the Herbert W. Armstrong College campus. And he's going to school and he's learning science and math and English and history and literature and music. And he and his fellow classmates at Imperial Academy don't have depraved educators forcing this kind of filth on them. And guess what? They're learning. They're receiving real education. And they're still able to enjoy their childhood. They're not even thinking about sex and sexual orientation and sexual experimentation. They're thinking about their science project. They're thinking about their studies, their music practice, things that 12-year-olds should be thinking about. That's something I thank God for profusely, regularly. Very few parents have the opportunity to give their children that kind of education. Most parents pretty well have to send their children to public school, and then they're having to face these kinds of battles all the time. Here's another story that emerged last month, a series of videos posted on YouTube by Canada-based sex education group Sex Ed School, featured on the Shaftesbury Kids YouTube channel. And what are these videos about? This is how the channel describes it. Sex Ed School is a fun new web series for kids to get real info from experts and discover all the answers they want to know now. The series that explores the birds and the bees with ease in today's digital landscape. Sex Ed School is a safe space where kids can talk openly and honestly about sexuality, the body, and healthy relationships. As you can imagine, they cover topics like transgenderism, gender expression, sexual orientation, many other topics I won't even mention. But I want to play a few clips from one of the videos on gender. And in this video, these women, they're talking to a room full of bright-eyed kids, probably 12 to 14 years old. Just imagine these kids listening and soaking it up.
Hi, I'm Nadine, a sex educator.
And I'm Eva, a sex researcher.
Today, we're going to use our Sex Ed School dolls, Blue and Ginger, to help you guess today's topic. Hey, Ginger, I'm Blue. I use the pronouns they and them.
Hi, Blue. Nice to meet you. I'm Ginger, and I use he and him pronouns. Gender is how you feel on the inside about whether you're a boy or a girl, a man or a woman, if you're non-binary, feel like neither or both.
Does anybody know what non-binary means?
It's like when you're neither female or male.
It's an umbrella term, so people can also be fluid, feel more like female, more like male, based on a different day or time. It's really individual.
Absolutely.
To learn a little bit more about gender, we're going to play a true or false game. Everyone born with a vulva is a girl. True or false?
Or identifies as a girl.
That's the sound of most of the kids raising up a sign with a T for true, though there are a few kids who think that that's a false statement.
Not everybody is sure, and that makes sense. But our genitals actually don't determine our gender, so some people born with vulvas can be boys. A boy can wear a dress and still be a boy.
We're all on this, it's true. So you can use how you style your hair or how you get dressed to show your gender to other people, but there aren't any clothes that are exclusive to one gender.
This has gone far beyond simply not teaching the precepts of the Bible or not teaching morality the way that Benjamin Rush and Samuel Adams said was foundational to education. This is teaching the opposite of the Bible. These educators are directly contradicting the Bible, and not to mention just contradicting common sense. But Deuteronomy 22 and verse 5 says, "The woman shall not wear that which pertains unto a man, neither shall a man put on a woman's garment, for all that do so are abomination unto the Eternal your God." That's pretty clear, but these educators don't feel any responsibility to respect the beliefs of any of the families of these children who may believe in the Bible. Then in the video, these teachers invite a special guest to speak to the children.
To help us learn a little bit more about gender, we actually have an extra special visitor to Sex Ed School.
His name is Caleb. He's trans, and he is here to answer all your questions about gender.
Oh, hello, everybody.
Hi.
I'm Caleb, and I'm here because I do workshops and stuff about gender. And so we're going to talk a little bit about gender.
This is a woman covered in tattoos, short cropped hair, dyed purple, speaking to a group of children who are sitting at her feet.
I have been through the spectrum, if we were to say a spectrum of like boys and girls. I have been everywhere in between. I was born a girl. And then when I was 2 years old, I told my mom for the first time that I was a boy.
This woman goes on to explain how she takes hormones to lower her voice. She describes surgeries she's had and so on and so forth. This education group that's producing these videos is financially backed by the Shaw Rocket Fund. It's a nonprofit organization that funds Canadian children's television and digital programs. It's Canada's largest private investor dedicated to Canadian children's media. They are coming after these kids. They are training them up in the way that they think these kids should go. Here's an article from the Daily Herald from Chicago, November 14th. The School Board of District 211 in Illinois voted last week in a 5-2 decision to allow biological males into the female locker room at Palatine High School. The board said that all students should be, quote, treated and supported in a manner consistent with their gender identity. So this means the girls in that school have no right to privacy. They have no right to use a locker room that doesn't have boys present. The report that the Daily Herald put out, they had a video interviewing a young woman at this high school who was there when the decision was handed down, and she's crying. This is what she said.
I feel uncomfortable that my privacy is being invaded. As I am a swimmer, I do change multiple times naked in front of the other students in the locker room. And I understand that the board has an obligation to all students, but I was hoping that they would go about this in a different way that would also accommodate students such as myself.
That hardly seems like too much to ask. But this is being forced on people. These board members, these educators don't care about your beliefs. They don't care about your privacy. They don't care about the privacy of this young woman or any of the women at this high school. They don't care. They are prioritizing the feelings of this boy who wants to act like a girl. And they are zealous to enforce this way of thinking. Here is another article, PJ Media from November 8th. All of these just within the last month. Last year in Canada, a first grade teacher told a 6-year-old girl that, quote, there is no such thing as girls and boys, and that, quote, girls are not real and boys are not real. According to the girl's parents, this caused their daughter a great deal of distress and amounted to discrimination against her. When the parents complained, the teacher defended her actions and the principal defended the teacher as well. The parents moved their daughter to a different school. That's the way this is going. If you don't like it, you have to move. You have to take your kids out of that environment because they are not going to accommodate you. These people are aggressive, and they are motivated by the devil, who really is coming after our children. He is aggressive, and we have to be aggressive in carrying out our responsibility as educators. Will Durant is a historian who wrote a book called The Story of Civilization. In the first volume of this series of books, he talks about just how fragile civilization is, that it's easily subject to destruction by forces from within and without, forces like natural disaster, disease epidemics, mental or moral decay, breakdown in the leadership, decline in family, class wars, disruptive revolutions, financial exhaustion. A lot of things can destroy a civilization. He says these are some of the ways in which a civilization may die. For civilization is not something inborn or imperishable. It must be acquired anew by every generation. And any serious interruption in its financing or its transmission may bring it to an end. Think about that. Civilization isn't inborn. It's not imperishable. It has to be acquired anew by every generation. And Durant makes this profound point. He says that the main factor in preserving civilization is education. Education, which may be defined as the technique of transmitting civilization. These evils that Satan has shoehorned into our educational system. These will destroy civilization in a single generation. These educators are creating a generation with no grounding in reality, with no moral compass, with no understanding of right and wrong, with a very twisted view of what reality is, a generation with no sense of history, a generation with no memory. And civilization is in peril. We'll take one more short break, and when we return, in today's last word, we'll reinforce just how much God wants us to remember our history by teaching it to our children in order to ensure that history survives, that the truth survives, that we ourselves survive as a people. We'll be right back.
It's time for today's last word.
Over and over in the Bible, God tells us to remember. Remember history. Remember your heritage. Remember the truth of God. Remember the old ways. He instructs parents to teach their children and grandparents to teach their grandchildren. He created us to live for 30 to 40 years after our childbearing years, because he wants three or four generations to be alive at one time. He wanted to make sure that children would have grandparents, even great-grandparents, because he wanted continuity. He wants the past to live. If we don't work to preserve it, it will die. The Philadelphia Church of God has been involved in some spectacular work in Jerusalem with archaeology. And there we carefully, meticulously dig through dirt looking for history. We find these little clay seals, the frailest fragments of history that is buried in those soils. And we preserve them. We build exhibits to put them on display. We invite the whole world to come look at these tiny little fragments of history. And we tell them, behold, behold this history. Behold the God behind it. That's really the way God wants us to treat all of our history. That's the way he wants us to treat his truth, to really work, to dig it up and to put it on display, to cling to it, to hold on to it, to exalt it. Now, those finds in Jerusalem don't just jump up out of the ground. We have to dig for them. If nobody ever dug, and then nobody put any kind of a value on them once they've been discovered, then those stones would not speak. They'd remain buried in the ground and mute. And really, that is true of all history. It dies unless we dig it up and preserve it. Think about the contrast between the way that we are going about our archaeological work over there. And there have been groups of people, Arabs in particular, who just want to destroy all of that. There have been times in the past where they've taken huge amounts of dirt from that area and they've just thrown it into a landfill because they're trying to erase that history. They're trying to erase that memory. That is what the devil does with history. And the more you understand how important history is to God, the more you can recognize Satan's devices and his efforts to obliterate history. Deuteronomy 32 records a parting song from the prophet Moses. He wrote this song to help the Israelites to commit these truths to their memory. And it says in verse 7 of Deuteronomy 32, "Remember the days of old. Consider the years of many generations. Ask your father, and he will show you, your elders, and they will tell you." Just one example of so many in the Bible that show how important it is to God that we remember our history. In this song, Moses talks about all the blessings that God gave to Israel, and then he talks about how Israel shamefully neglected the God who saved them. That's what human nature does. We just cast these truths aside. We forget about those things. We get focused on the present moment. But Moses was reminding them of their history, God wants us to remember that history. He wants us to remember how people go off track lest history repeat itself. If you don't remember, you're going to make the same mistakes that your forefathers did. And that song in Deuteronomy 32, it ends in verse 43. And then Moses says, "Set your hearts unto the words, all the words which I testify among you this day, which you shall command your children to observe to do, all the words of this law, because it is your life. And through this thing, you shall prolong your days in the land." Commit this to memory. Etch it in your mind. Teach it to your children. This is your life. This is how you can hold fast. This is how you can prolong your days. And you look at what happened in Israel after Moses was gone from the scene. And basically you had one man, Joshua, and he was surrounded by his loyal officers who paid attention and remembered what Moses was teaching here. But as a nation, Israel forgot. They forgot over and over and over. And you look at the overview that you get in the New Testament, in church history, and again, people forgot over and again. The only way that that will not happen to us is if we work, if we dig and preserve and share and teach that important knowledge. In the world tomorrow, once Jesus Christ comes and establishes his government on this earth, Isaiah prophesies that God's knowledge will cover the earth. Now, it doesn't cover the earth today. God's knowledge is exceedingly rare. In fact, it is buried by worldly knowledge. It's buried by worldly ways of living and doing. That's what covers the earth today. And if we want to survive that, then we have to build an ark of God's truth. We have to get on board that so that we can weather the storm. We have to work to preserve that truth. In 1 Corinthians 15, the Apostle Paul wrote, "I declare unto you the gospel which I preached unto you, which also you have received, and wherein you stand, by which also you are saved, if you keep in memory what I preached unto you." This is instruction that will save you if you remember it. Your salvation depends on keeping this in memory, your memory and that of your children and your grandchildren. Study to learn the way that you should go, and then teach and train your children in the way that they should go. Do all you can to cling to the truth, to cling to true history. Keep it, guard it, protect it, cherish it. Be sure to teach it so that it will be preserved in the next generation and on into eternity. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on the program today to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Cicero. History is the witness that testifies to the passing of time. It illumines reality, vitalizes memory, provides guidance in daily life, and brings us tidings of antiquity. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.